Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the Subcommittee on Human Services of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Today is June 10th. We have several things on our agenda today. We're not going to be addressing them in the exact order they're printed on the page. We're going to begin with 2828 and then move to work sessions on budgets and then conclude with Senate Bill 478, which is a continuation of a hearing that ran long at our previous session. We will continue with 478, Senate Bill 478, if there is time after we've completed our work on these other items. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2828. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, 2 years ago, the legislature passed House Bill 3260, which required OHA to contract with a third party to conduct a study to examine various options for financing health care delivery. That study was never funded. This bill simply extends the sunset for that study and includes a blank appropriation. The agency estimates that a study of this magnitude would cost around $600,000.
Thank you. We have two people here to speak to this bill. Representative, would you come join us?
Good morning. Thank you, colleagues, for having me. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I represent House District 45 in Northeast Portland, Maywood Park and Park Rose. And I'm slightly discombobulated. I had planned to defer primarily to Senator Michael Denbro, who has been long involved and supportive of this issue. But I'm happy to speak briefly in support. I know you have a lot on your agenda today, as always. And I also am in another sub in which I was ducking out for a few moments. Your staff did a wonderful job of summarizing the bill before you. As you know, this House Bill 3260 did authorize the OHA to contract this, to do this study. 2 years ago, we got it out without any funding source, hoping that some private funding would be found. A small amount was. And over the time since then, the concern is this is still a need that is pretty significant with all the transitions in healthcare provision, both in this state and nationally. I think the need continues for really getting a good assessment of different healthcare delivery systems. And so we have come back to you again with this request, hoping to get some, to use everyone's favorite phrase I've decided of this session, which is to have the state have some skin in the game on this, with the kind of, we talk about leveraging money from the state to get other private money, and that is what we are asking for here, for an investment from the state, not for the entire cost, but for part of the cost, to then leverage that with private money and then utilize this to really give us, I think, some really significant information about how different systems are working now and assessing what the best one will be. And with that, I want to defer briefly to my fine colleague, only right now on my right, Senator Denbro.
Hi. Thank you. I'm Michael Denbro, State Senator for District 23. That is Northeast and Southeast Portland and the lovely city of Maywood Park in between. You know, she's getting pretty good, you know, Barbara. You know, I think she gave a very good presentation of it. It was exciting for us 2 years ago when we passed House Bill 3260, got a lot of support. We were, you know, obviously in a worse financial time there, and on the other hand, perhaps we're more optimistic that we could raise money privately to fund this study. But we heard a lot, or at least, you know, the people who were doing the fundraising heard that they wanted to see some state investment, which they would be happy to match. But it was important that this be seen as a partnership. And so that is why we're bringing this bill back to you. In the form of House Bill 2828, first of all, just simply to be able to extend the timeline for this study to allow it to happen. We still believe that it will be very valuable for the state to get this information, but also to have the wherewithal to move forward with it. You will be followed, I think, by Dr. Sam Metz, who has been the real lead on this and is in a position to answer any questions that you have. But if there are any technical questions about the bill or the process, the representative and I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you. I'd like for you to help us recall what the hope was in the last session for the total cost and how much might be raised. And when the representative mentioned skin in the game, the first thing that flashed through my mind is that's what happens if I would try to be skateboarding right now. I'm looking at this. It's a request for a large sum of money. Does that mean there would be another $600,000 raised privately so that the cost of the study would be $1.2 million? This seems like quite a bit more than what was anticipated in the last session. Could you help me understand what the total cost should be and who's matching what to what?
Sure. Co-Chair Nathanson, you know, and I think Dr. Metz can probably answer this better, but we don't believe that, we believe that the study can be done for much less than is on that cost sheet. We think that it can be done for just maybe $300,000. And, you know, if one were doing such a study from scratch, if we were the very first state to be looking at these issues, perhaps it could be that expensive. However, I believe that the people that will be contracted to do the study will start by reviewing studies that have already been done in other states, and then they'll be able to really focus their attention on what is unique about Oregon. Now, there is a lot that is unique about Oregon, given our, you know, healthcare reform, the CCOs, our aversion to sales taxes, you know, things like that. You know, that, I think, is where the focus of the attention will be. And again, I think Dr. Metz can help with that.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Samuel Metz.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am Sam Metz. I'm a Portland physician, and I helped help participate in creating the original 3260 draft of the study. Some background: as you just heard, there have been approximately two dozen previous studies, national and state, that seek to do the same thing, that look at different ways of financing statewide health care to find the most efficient one. The good news is that every one of these studies, more than two dozen, about 28, has discovered a better way to finance health care, either in the state or nationally, to provide better care to more people for less money. In Oregon, we spend approximately $40 billion each year on health care. We don't have an exact number because we don't have a study yet. But the results of this study could potentially provide more Oregonians with better care for, based on other studies, $3 to $4 billion less per year. The studies that have been conducted before us have been done by probably a dozen different kinds of organizations, private and public, financed by different kinds of organizations, state legislatures and private organizations. And they have all universally found better ways to finance healthcare. The cost of these various studies has ranged in today's dollars, considering that some of these studies are now 20 years old, anywhere from $200,000 to $600,000. Our study probably falls midway between those two. We have not yet put the study out for bids, but we already have interest from several organizations in conducting the study. Thank you very much. If there are other questions about the financing of the study, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Could you please explain to me in how you would interpret the idea of the state showing skin in the game? How much investment should the state make hoping to attract other private investment? And how much private investment was raised prior to this year?
As you heard before, there's interest in business and from private citizens in the results of the study. But the contributions, the willingness to contribute, has been guarded. I found many contributors, I'm the primary fundraiser, I found many contributors who were willing to contribute the last 5,000 but not the first 5,000. And of course everyone wants to know who else has already contributed. Having the state invest most of the money would generate a significant amount of interest in the private community, in Oregon's business community, that would ensure that this study was done very well, that we had a sufficient amount of funding to attract the right kinds of organizations to do this, and so that all of the options that are required to be explored in this study are done in depth.
Okay.
Was that helpful?
Yeah, very helpful. Thank you. Is that all? Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2828. And for those of you who are just joining us recently, Senate Bill 478, which is carried over from a previous meeting, we will take that up toward the end of this meeting as time allows. We're going to make sure that we get our budget work done first. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 5526, Oregon Health Authority. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, so today is like our first real big budget, and so I want to give you a little bit about process. We're going to run this budget in pieces, partly because it's big and takes time, but partly because that way we can get part of it settled when we don't have decisions on the other parts. And then, so each part, we will take preliminary action to move that recommendation to the bill. But then at the end, there will be a final action that will take all the pieces and put them together. And also at the end, we will do the KPMs and any budget notes that have been approved. So you'll see in OLIS, there's three separate documents, one for medical assistance programs, and then one for PEB and one for OAB. And we'll start with the medical assistance programs. And each document has a summary memo that I'll go through, and also where I'll read the final recommendation, and then has some more detailed work papers behind it. Okay, so the medical assistance programs, looking at the memo, the LFO recommended total funds budget 14.6% higher than the current biennium, primarily the result of the continuation of the Affordable Care Act expansion. And the general fund budget is 10% higher than the 13-15 budget. A few highlights, but again, we'll go through more detail on the worksheet. It continues to cap cost increases at 3.4% per person per year. It continues the hospital assessment per House Bill 2395 that was passed earlier in the session. Utilizes a total of $145 million of hospital assessment that is expected to be left over at the end of this biennium. It includes general fund savings from a variety of sources, either cost savings or revenues, including the spring 2015 caseload forecast, a change in the federal match rate, the May tobacco tax forecast, and some additional drug rebate revenues that were not anticipated at this level. Total general fund savings as a result is about $131 million. It also includes the cost of the MAGI transfer project. That's the new the Medicaid eligibility system that we're still trying to get finished. And I'll talk a little more in detail about that. It also includes the eligibility staff required to continue what we've called the hybrid process that we're running to enroll members in the health plan and to do the redeterminations. And finally, it partially restores dental benefits that were reduced in 2010 and 2012. And with that, I'll flip over to the second page, which is the detailed worksheet. And since this is a little different than the regular Orbitz budget documents that we use for the other agencies, I'll go through the sheet a little bit to start out with. We will use this same format for both OHA and DHS, going program by program. So you see, the first line is the legislatively approved budget for the current biennium. That does include the rebalance that we did just a few weeks ago, so it's the current numbers. The second line is the current service level. That was developed way long ago, like almost a year now. So, and it includes the inflation assumptions capped at the 3.4% per year per person. It includes the caseload forecast back from the spring of 2014. And it does include the sunset of the hospital assessment, which is why you see a big increase in the need for general fund and a big decrease in other funds. It assumed that sunset because that was current law at the time. And then the third line, the governor's budget, at that point we're including the fall 2014 caseload. And now when we go through the final recommendations, we will be updating this budget to the newest caseload from this spring. We actually make all of our adjustments from the current service level as it was at governor's budget. That's the line one on the numbered lines. Then I'll just go through bit by bit, and please feel free to interrupt because I know some of this sounds like code when I start putting in abbreviations, and sometimes I forget to be clear. The first section, lines 3 through 7, is the whole first section, 2 through 15, are existing packages that were included in the governor's budget. So we need to take action on them. It doesn't mean we have to approve them, but that's where all of those things are coming from. So in the December emergency board, we did a rebalance for the current biennium, but some of the actions we took at that rebalance affected 15-17 biennium, and that's what those adjustments are. So FQHC, Federally Qualified Health Centers, had some cost increases, and they have moved to some of the clinics have moved to an alternative payment methodology, which is causing temporarily some increased costs. And we're going to see that down below, so I was going to go ahead and spend a minute on that. As clinics are interested, we are trying to move them to a prospective payment methodology, much more similar to the CCOs. That alternative methodology also gives them more flexibility in how they spend their money and what they can get match on, again, similar to the CCOs. So there's some good policy reasons for doing this. However, you have this transition period where for one clinic, you're paying the prospective payment for the next year, but you're also still paying them for the last 6 months that you haven't finished catching up on the old payments. So you get this temporary need for some additional funding. In the long run, it's cost neutral, or the hope is if you're actually providing better care because of how you're treating people, that the system as a whole can see savings.
Can I offer a comment there so people understand? The FQHCs have been based on a fee-for-service basis with wraparound, so they get paid basically at cost. And that was the old model because it made sense. We didn't have a lot of people who were not insured. The FQHCs did a huge job in taking care of those people, which we really appreciate. Now that most people in Oregon are insured, they have that population there, and we're trying to move them to essentially a global budget. You're going to have a capitated budget for them as a different payment methodology. But in the billing systems you go through in healthcare, you're always 3 to 6 months behind as the bills come through. You have to cover them while you're moving to this new system. And I think that's what we're talking about. And that's right. Not just for FQHCs. That's the way everything works in the state in healthcare. So you're always running accounts receivables that are 6 months, sometimes a year up even. And so we have to cover the back door sort of while we move them forward on this. I'm hoping what we'll do is we'll be moving more and more FQHCs to this. It's a more logical way of dealing with your costs. Some of the FQHCs had difficulty maintaining themselves simply because the billing was so slow getting through. So there's an advantage there for them, and we can help them control costs better by setting prices ahead of time. This is the amount of money you have. This is the population you serve. Now let's be efficient against that money. So it's a good program, but it looks funny when you look at it this way. I'm hoping in time all the FQHCs move to this program and we'll have a better control of costs. If I misspoke, tell me, okay?
And I would add that many states are concerned about paying the FQHCs at cost, which is considerably higher than we would pay most Medicaid providers. And that is by federal regulation, but I think many states are interested in pushing the feds a little bit on that now that most people are insured, but not all. Then on line 5, health insurer fee increase, again, that was something we adjusted budgets for in December. That's a fee that certain of the CCOs have to pay as part of the ACA. Line 6, cost per case adjustments that were made based on the forecast in the fall. And then transfers and some miscellaneous limitation adjustments.
Ms. Ames, could you comment on our confidence level in number 6, which is a $31 million adjustment?
I don't think there's great angst about that particular one. I think there's more angst about as we get down to line 20, which is the current forecast. That forecast is based off the rates that were set in January, and as we've heard several times, the agency is working through a process and a contractor to look at those rates and be sure that they were set appropriately.
Thank you.
Okay, then on line 8, package 90, again, those were specific adjustments in the governor's budget. The governor's budget assumed the continuation of the hospital assessment at that base rate of 5.3%. That's as per Senate Bill 2395 now. Remember, I had mentioned in current service level that was taken out, so these are the adjustments needed to put those dollars back in. Line 10, the hospital assessment transformation pool. In the current biennium, 1% of the total hospital assessment went back to the hospitals in the form of through this transformation pool, and were linked to certain in outcomes and incentives and metrics.
It's 1 percentage point.
Right.
Or 20% of the assessment. You're
right.
Roughly. CCO's got a half, they got a half.
So that was during 13-15. The hospitals have agreed to split that 1% now. So now CCOs will get half based on metrics, and the hospitals will get half, again, based on their achievement of performance metrics. Line 11 is where you see the carryover of the hospital assessment at $125 million. That's the money that will be left at the end of this biennium. That was the amount known when the governor put together her budget. Line 12, the tobacco settlement agreement, or the TMSA money. This is where that whole thing was at in governor's budget. At that point, all the TMSA money was put in the health plan, and we'll talk about that more when we see the adjustments down below. IMD is Institution of Mental Disease. Oregon, like most states, have always claimed a match on A&D residential facilities greater than 16 beds. The feds have really been cracking down on that, and we had a rebalance during the last biennium where we backfilled $16 million general fund for the loss of that match. This $2 million savings in GF is accounting for the agency's efforts as they move forward to get more of our patients into the smaller beds, the smaller facilities that we can get the match on. That will undoubtedly be an ongoing effort. And once again, I know there's a lot of work going on with the feds and many states pushing back on that decision. And finally, on line 14, there's $1 million total funds to fund the fee-for-service portion of the psychiatric emergency services. That's the consortium being put together in the legacy building up in Portland to create an emergency department specifically for psychiatric. That would probably open near the end of next biennium.
Yeah, I hope everyone understands the port. That's a model for the rest of the state in many ways. It's instead of taking people to prison and taking them to the emergency room, you take them to the new facility and they get treated there. They believe they can stabilize people in 24 hours. I must take that at, that they really can. It's amazing they can. And then get them into treatment facilities afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it's being modeled across the state. I know other counties doing the same thing. Mm-hmm.
So this money would be used for operations, not capital. It's not anything to do with capital.
Right. This is really more of a placeholder to it would be if Medicaid patients went there for treatment, it would be to pay that.
And presumably they would get reimbursed in another biennium. I'm assuming that we come up with a reimbursement model there that will be long-term sustainable.
The payment they'll have to have special codes for this work they're going to do there within 24 hours of developing those codes.
Right.
For the Medicaid patients, they'll get paid for that. There may be other patients who are not Medicaid patients or commercial patients that won't be. This just won't be a Medicaid facility.
Right.
The potential here is huge for really helping people with mental issues.
Right.
And the savings to the state that you won't see here,
right,
because they're in corrections,
right,
and they're in emergency room visits and in hospital visits. It's massive,
yeah.
So it's the right direction to go.
I'm 1,000% supportive. I just hope that it comes, you know, if it is cost effective, then I hope that Medicaid and private insurance will end up paying for that code so that we don't have to keep taking from the general fund.
The CCOs are incredibly supportive of this program,
yep,
and other programs across the state the same,
yep,
way. They know this is the way to go.
Yep.
And then starting at line 16 are the legislative adjustments that have happened since all that other stuff. So on line 18, TMSA, many things going on with TMSA. First of all, the forecast for the 15-17 biennium for the revenue went down $11 million. So that's covered here with additional general fund instead. Decisions were made to continue to fund the $4 million in public health for tobacco prevention and cessation. So $4 million will leave the health plan and go to public health instead, 4.1 with inflation. The $4 million will also continue for the Department of Ed to do PE programs. And $16 million is moved to AMH, allowing the putting in a little bit more general fund into the health plan at more of a long-run general fund growth rate level. Line 19, the MAGI transfer project and the eligibility staff will cost $12.4 million general fund. At this point, this is an estimate, and these will undoubtedly keep changing and probably will be in discussion as we go into the next rebalance. After the failure of the Oracle project, Oregon is now in the process of bringing in a system from Kentucky, that's why it says the transfer project, to do the eligibility determination and redeterminations. Meanwhile, as I mentioned, we are running this hybrid system using the Oracle software where we can, but it involves a lot of manual process. This system is expected to be completed somewhere around the end of the year and implemented early in the spring. So of the $12.4 million general fund cost, about $3.7 million of it is actually the IT project, getting Kentucky. Kentucky comes free because it was funded with federal funds, but there's a lot of work to connect it up to our other pieces, the MMIS system and security and, you know, all the things that go with that. 8.7 of the total is related to the additional call center eligibility staff that are needed until we get the system up and running, as well as the IT staff that's been needed to continue this hybrid process. Line 20, the caseload forecast, we talked a little bit about the risks there. And you'll see that there's a decrease in general fund. The caseload forecasts for those categories that cost general fund are down considerably. And in particular, notice TANF, which as we come out of the recession, we would expect to see that caseload come down. But you'll see there's also an increase in federal funds. The forecast does predict that the ACA population will be a little higher than we had predicted last forecast. The health plan average biennial level is anticipated to be just over 1 million people in 15-17. Line 21 is the additional drug rebate revenue we now expect of $10 million. That's probably coming in the current biennium, actually. And 22, the federal match changed a little bit, which gives us some savings in general fund.
That was good news.
Line 23 is additional hospital assessment that we expect to be left over at the end of the biennium. Let's see.
Can I apologize for that? I forgot to turn it off. And my wife just told me that she completed her last course and she's graduating Saturday now.
Woo!
Congratulations, Lori.
Line 24, additional other fund revenue. Saving additional revenues of $26 million. And this partially could be related to hospital assessment. I just wanted to back up a little bit. The hospital assessment rate is not set in statute. The rate floats to achieve equilibrium in the system between the revenues generated and the allowable expenditures. And that is how the bills, Senate Bill 2395, sets the system up. The revenue assumptions in this line assumes that the rate might float a little higher than at the 5.3 base level, but that is not a certain thing. The agency will monitor that rate as revenues and expenditures proceed through the biennium and adjust that rate if needed, either up or down. Alternatively, there is a possibility of other fund revenues that could come in, such as more drug rebate revenues that may come in before the end of the biennium, which won't close out till late next fall, or in the upcoming biennium. Line 25 is the restoration of dental benefits, the partial restoration. This one was just really intriguing because we got down in the weeds. So we would again cover crowns for adults Now we only cover pregnant women and kids. We cover kids more generally for adults. We would cover dentures when dentally appropriate, and we would allow replacement every 10 years. Currently, no replacements are allowed. And again, pregnant women and children are 7-year replacements. And it would, again, pay for partial dentures, which could be replaced every 5 years, and now it's 10.
And thank you for that. We probably found out and learned more about dental care than I ever wanted to during this process. I'm not ready to be a dentist, but at least I understand now. And I do want to thank the dental care organizations for coming together and giving us a common benefit that made sense for people. Frankly, without dentures, you can't get a job, and it leads to all kinds of other illnesses outside of the mouth that affect the entire body. As Senator Winters has said so many times, we finally figured out that that your mouth is not separated from the rest of your body. In my case, it's directly connected to my foot, but that's a different story. Okay, so thank you for the work on that.
Line 26, the federally qualified health centers. This funding allows 3 additional federally qualified health centers to move to the alternative payment methodology starting July 1 of 2015. There may be others that want to come onto this methodology, and we would expect the agency to come back in the rebalance and talk about what the plan might be for the next phase and what the estimated costs would be.
And again, it's an additional cost, but this is a temporary situation because over
right.
time it equals out. But for a short time, it's like you're paying twice.
Right.
How many forward and paying back.
How many FQHCs do we have?
It's like 21 or 2. How many? 32. I couldn't remember the exact number. And the next question, I guess, would be how many have changed over, about 6 or 7 or something? I know it's a slow process.
That's my vague recollection.
Eight. So I'm pretty close. Okay. This is off the top of my head stuff, so and there's not much up there. So as we move towards it, we'll see more of this. I think doing it, rolling through a couple of budgets is a better way of doing it than trying to do it all at once. So it's a reasonable way to go about it. The big part to me on it is once you get to global budgets like that, it no longer incents you to do more and more and more. It incents you to be more and more efficient. And I think that's the way we want to make this go forward.
Line 27, the May forecast included an increase in the tobacco tax forecast. And a number of technical adjustments and transfers. Generally, these are zero across the agency. It's moving pieces around. I think some of this may be in anticipation of the reorganization, but some of it's just kind of, remember this agency's only been its own agency for 4 years, and they're still trying to make certain little pieces work better. This particular one is a lot of money. It moves the Care Assist program. That's the out of medical assistance programs and over to public health. That's the program for we get federal and other fund revenues that are dedicated to HIV related medical and drug costs. And finally, line 29, you're going to see this in all the divisions, so I'll take a minute to explain it here and then I won't bother. In the governor's budget, there were adjustments made for assumptions about a different AG rate and different state government service charges rates. We are going to undo those adjustments in this budget, because when we get to the end of session bill, LFO will do all those adjustments, not necessarily at the same level as the governor's budget. So first we're going to undo it, and then we're going to redo it later, maybe at a little bit different level. This is really to just keep all those adjustments clean. If I leave all the netting out to happen at the end of session, it will be chaos. They're generally small, as you can see. But. And that's it for the medical assistance programs.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move the LFO preliminary budget recommendation to Senate Bill 5526.
Discussion. Objections.
Just a couple comments real quick, if I could. There's been a lot of people working a very long time on this. I particularly want to thank Linda for your hard work on this. I really do appreciate it. I know we've been a thorn in your side sometimes, and we'll continue to be so. But really appreciate your work and your common sense and keeping us calm sometimes, too. So thank you for your hard work. I do appreciate it. I also want to thank Lynn Saxton and the director of OHA. She's been a breath of fresh air, really great to work with. She's on the hot seat most of the time. I think she's still talking to me. When it gets down to a meeting in her house over issues, I think that's above and beyond. Oh, the dog does scare me.
Sorry.
You know, it was Brian?
Bruce.
And what was his name?
Bruce.
It would be. Okay.
It's probably intentional.
Yeah.
So. He's a rescue dog.
Yeah.
But has some issues.
He really does.
Yeah.
He about knocked out my assistant. He jumped up, caught him in the chin, and wow, I thought he was going out. Anyway. But a fun dog, and a lot of other people too. This is a big budget. A lot of decisions to be made in it. A lot of puts and takes. But overall, I think it's a good budget. We're really helping a lot of people in the state. When we're talking a million people being insured, that is almost unbelievable numbers. And that's why we're at 95% in the state. So, and to my co-chair, who's been in my mind great on this one, and even better on the other one, the DHS one. I really appreciate your hard work with me. Thank you.
Any objections to the motion? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, then we'll move on to the PEB recommendations. This one has one extra sheet, and that I'll explain. But first, look at the memo. This is almost a $1.8 billion budget, other funds. 9.7% higher than the 13-15 approved budget. It continues to cap the expenditure growth at 3.4% per employee per year. That's consistent with the Oregon Educators Benefit Board and the Oregon Health Plan. It includes three new positions to address workload related to improved technology and automation, new medical plan options with new insurers and variations in plan design. PEB last year went through an RFP process and brought on a number of new insurers. And it also will bring in the administration of the GEM subsidy program in-house, as well as two small groups, the early retirees and the semi-independent groups. And then the second page is the model that we've used the last couple of times now with PEB to actually cap the growth rate. So I did want to emphasize the growth rate that is capped is really core benefits, and that is the benefits that the state mostly pays for. So it's medical, dental, and vision. So there's all these calculations where you can see the historic rates that through 14, you can see the last 3 years have been pretty good, pretty low increases in costs. And then below that, the rates are simply grown at 3.4% per year. There is a modest increase in employees covered, assumed. And you'll remember in the rebalance, we added some additional limitation to PEB for the current biennium, primarily because they ended up having more new employees than we had built into the model to start with. So then you see the calculation of the capped for core benefits. And then below that, we've added in the dollars for the optional benefits, which are things like life insurance, disability, long-term care insurance, the things where people generally pay full cost themselves. But it still runs through this budget, so they still need the limitation for it. And finally, you see the addition for the PEB operational budget, just under $10 million. Then if you go to the third page, you see the usual worksheets, although there isn't a whole lot going on with this one compared to the medical assistance programs. So you do see on line three is the limitation for the cost of the three new positions. I did want to note that the agency estimates that by bringing in some of these things in-house, the gym subsidy program and the early retiree and semi-independent management, that they may be able to save as much as $600 a year of third-party administration costs. So the positions basically pay for themselves in that regard. And then line seven is just the adjustment number that comes from the model in order to get to the bottom line that the model has calculated. And then finally, the last thing is the small adjustments for Attorney General. That's it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the LFO preliminary budget recommendation of Senate Bill 5526.
Discussion. Yes.
Just real quick again, this has been a pretty well a success as far as I'm concerned. We took this budget over 4 years ago. This is our second time around on it. It was not capped. They were already starting to do some good work. Their wellness programs are starting to work and starting to bring costs down. I still think there's ways they can save more. And when you consider our PERS issues and other issues that we have surrounding this population, anything we can save on this side helps the overall picture. Some of the CCOs are now stepping up and offering programs for the PEP program. It'll be interesting to see if they actually save more than the others do. So I think that we're going to be going through the next 2 years looking at this program again, seeing if there'll be more savings. But overall, from my point of view at least, generally speaking, they're doing the right thing, they're moving in the right direction, they're holding costs down, and I'm glad to see that. It's something that needed to be done. We had uncontrolled costs prior to 4 years ago, and I have to give some credit here to the PEB board and to OHA and the director for actually working with us and helping hold these costs down. So thanks for your work.
Any other discussion? Objections to the motion? Motion passes.
And the last budget today, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. From the memo, the recommended budget for total funds is 5% lower than the 13-15 legislatively approved budget. That is simply that the limitation provided in 13-15 was significantly higher than will actually be spent. So we're basically adjusting off a base that wasn't quite accurate. Let's see. So this budget then does also, like the other, cap expenditure growth at 3.4% per employee per year. It eliminates the non-limited other fund expenditures and instead uses limited other fund expenditures, which is capped. The primary difference from a technical perspective is that when you have non-limited expenditure limitation, it can be adjusted administratively. You don't actually have to come back to the legislature to do it, whereas the limited other funds takes a legislative action to increase. So there's a say in general, there's more scrutiny over limited other funds. It includes two other items, package 409 called Transparency and Engagement for $450,000 other funds, which will enable OEB to continue to make its online plan selection tool available to employees and allow for some enhancements. That tool was originally financed with a grant, and this will allow them to continue and I think it's been very well received by their members. Their members have a lot of choices. It's not easy to decide. There's also one new position in this agency or this group to address workload, partly related to the implementation of House Bill 2279. I think from 2 years ago, which allows cities, counties, other municipalities to participate in either OWEB or PEB. And this this position would really deal with workload related to both of them. At this point, there's been more interest in OWEB, and as well as other workload issues. OWEB will be going out for an RFP soon in time for their for next year, not this plan year, but the next year. And as PEB learned, there is a great deal of staff work related to that process. Okay, and again, on your second sheet, you see the same model, different historic data, but all the same concept. Their plan year runs a little different, so the actual calculations include, their plan year runs from October 1 through September 30th, more consistent with the school year. So 15-16 is nine months out of that, the full 12 months out of 16-17, and only 3 months out of the 17-18 calculations go into the biennial average here. And again, the optionals are added and the OWEB operations at about $13 million. And then if you work at the look at the final worksheet, you see line three is the one position I talked about. Line four is where we actually switch out the non-limited and do the adjustments to the limited to come out to the bottom line that the model produced. And line four is their package 409 for their enrollment tool. And then line nine does include a transfer over of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which previously had been in the medical assistance programs.
Can I ask a question on that last statement? Mm-hmm. The Oregon Prescription Drug Program does what now? It
currently is located in the medical assistance programs. I think it's only two staff, yeah. And they're going to move it over to OWEB.
Any reason?
I'm sure there is. Okay. I don't know what it is.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I move the LFO permanent budget recommendation of Senate Bill 5526.
Discussion. Yes.
As always, sorry. This is a particularly difficult budget to wrap your arms around. Each school district has its own bargaining units. They all have these huge number of choices. We have issues with retired employees getting health insurance paid for or not, or buying in. It's done on a per employee basis, not a per member basis. There's questions about how much a cost to insure a family or an individual. Both PEB and this one are going to have difficulty with being in a situation where they're going to be taxed if we don't make some changes in the next 2 or 3 years. And it's just extremely difficult to look at all these various programs inside this to make any significant impact on it. They have been holding their costs to the cap. I'm fearful that may not continue. There's going to be huge pressure on most of the people who receive these benefits on the other side of the equation with PERS after what the courts did this spring. So this is still in transition as far as I'm concerned. And then you have the question between the relationship between PEB and OWEB. Should there be one board? Should there be two boards? They keep separate. We've got a lot of work to do with this in the coming years, and we're going to have to look at it carefully. In some ways, I look at PEB and OWEB as the only way we can start equalizing some of the PERS issues so that we don't start losing services for the public and start losing services in schools. As an example, this morning, speaking with the school board for and superintendent for Ashland Public Schools, they've been self-insured and outside of OWEB. They've cut costs dramatically. They're adding a school year this year. They have not cut anybody during the recession. They're reducing their class sizes, and because they're open enrollment, they have 300 new students coming in. there's something going on in some of these schools that are not going on in some of the other schools, and we need to look at that and have that discussion over the interim and into the next session. We've got to make this a better program for everybody, but not only the employees, but for the kids. And when you're putting this much money into health care, the other issues we've got, I think we have to look at this carefully and see if we can come up with something that will help to move forward.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I believe that that was part of the debate before we decided to go in this direction. I believe it was 2009 and before, because some of the districts maintained that they could probably be more efficient and more cost-effective than if we had it. So your point is well taken.
Yep. One of the things we may want to consider, the OEB does not want to hear, is do you allow more districts to go self-insured if they can prove they can save money?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And instead, the pressure is right now to force them back into OEB, into a program that will cost them more money, it'll have bigger classroom sizes, and have a shortened school year. So it's a real issue for us to look at. It's going to be very political and very difficult. We're not going to fix it here this morning, but we will this afternoon.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say
your psychosis.
I always suspected this, but now I know it's true, that Dr. Senator Bates is clairvoyant, and he answered all the questions I wasn't even sure how to ask, and then some. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Objections? Motion passes. Ms. Ames, that concludes our work on this bill at this time. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 5526. We're going to take a brief recess while some people may choose to leave the room, and we will prepare for opening the remainder of the public hearing on Senate Bill 478. So we'll be in recess for just a minute or so.
Thank you. Good job.
Brief interruption for everybody else to clear the room. Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer, we're starting the hearing now.
Do you want me to move up there?
Thank you. Senator Edwards, you'll be first. Come on up. We are I'm opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 478. This is to conclude testimony that we did not complete at our previous meeting.
Great.
So we have three legislators who we will hear from this morning. Senator Edwards.
Great. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Chris Edwards, State Senator from Eugene, and a lot has been said about this bill, and we've worked a lot on the bill, and I'm flying blind without my notes this morning because I came from another hearing because I didn't know that this would be up this morning. But this bill, we've worked on it for a long time. I'm here supporting the Dash 18 amendments. I believe that we need to do the Dash 16s as well. I don't know if those, and I need clarification from staff whether or not those need to be rolled into one amendment. The Dash 18 amendments changed the definition of contaminant and intentionally added essentially mirror that definition that's in the Washington law currently. You had a lot of really good testimony about the necessity of the bill yesterday. The one thing that I would add in response to opponents of the bill that have talked about product safety standards that exist at the federal level and whatnot is that really one of the reasons we need this bill is that on an individual product level, an individual product may or may not be safe. I mean, we all understand how the politics of passing bills plays out. And so I would say that I have a little bit more confidence in our judgment here in Oregon about what we think is protective than what our federal Congress might deem as protective. That's my opinion. I'm sure other people have different opinions. But I would also say that beyond whether or not an individual product is safe, one of the reasons we are seeking passage of this bill is because these chemicals are ubiquitous in a child's environment. It's not just what's in one particular toy. It is the total loading, the total chemical load in a child's environment. So that is one of the key points that is not really addressed when if you focus just on the safety of the chemical level in one particular product. So I just wanted to add that we're supportive of the Dash 16s, the Dash 18s. I'm happy to walk through how the bill rolls out between now and 8 years from now, when product phase out actually goes into effect. And it is a fairly lengthy timeline, but I think you guys have probably had a lot of exposure to the bill, and I'm happy to answer questions. So
thank you. Senator Bates, do you want to ask or wait for the next two?
Let's wait for the next two, and I'll ask questions after that if I could.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, State Representative for House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I have prepared a testimony, part of which I submitted to the Senate Environment Committee and will submit again, that goes into more details about why this bill is so important, the specific chemicals that it deals with, and the specific chronic diseases and conditions and related costs to our state as a result of that. I think that I'm not going to go into that because you heard a lot of that yesterday. I'm happy to if you ask me questions about it. But what I do want to say is a couple things. One is the genesis of the bill. Originally, the legislature tried to ban BPA, but there was a growing recognition that, number one, that's just one chemical out of many that shows up repeatedly in children's bodies, human cord, breast, milk, et cetera. And the other is that if it gets replaced, it might be replaced with something that is even more harmful. And so this legislation resulted out of years of that discussion and came to you first in 2012. And Senator Bates, thank you for being the co-chief sponsor that particular year, where we tried to take a very different approach, which was how do you identify what the chemicals are that are most harmful to children and show up most predominantly? And Washington was ahead of us, had done a lot of that work. 2008, with strong bipartisan support, had passed their disclosure bill. We really wanted to build on that. And so that was the first thing I want to say, is that this is a very different approach of saying what are the most common chemicals and how do we start tracking that so we know what's happening. And beyond that, how do we start phasing it out? It's not enough just to track it when we know it occurs over and over again. I also want to thank Senator Steiner Hayward in 2013 for being a co-chief sponsor, along with Senator Boquist and Representative Jason Conger. At that point, his child had been at a young age exposed to lead, and he became very passionate about this. The following year, in 2014, I had Senator Edwards join, Representative Gomberg join, and Representative Jason Conger still very involved. Sorry to lose him to this. And then this year, again, co-sponsors along with chief sponsors, along with thank you to Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Gelser, and Mark Johnson, Representative Mark Johnson. I want to point out that there's had been Republican support for this all along the way, and you can see from the chief sponsors of it, these are very moderate colleagues who work very closely with industry to find something that works for everyone. So I think talking about the genesis of the bill is very important. I also want to point out that because the scientific evidence that links certain chemicals to chronic diseases, disorders, and costs is so well established, this bill is supported not only by businesses and community groups and environmental groups, but every major health group in the state, from Oregon Medical Association, Oregon Nurses Association, Public Health Institute, Public Health Association, MODA, Providence, Legacy, Kaiser, et cetera. It is very well. We've had years and years of work. And there's been years of work. I know, Senator Bates, you asked at the last hearing that we had, that we go back and really work again with industry to try to come to some compromises. I want to thank, in particular, Senator Edwards, who has spent countless hours sitting down with industry, as I had in previous years, and bringing you these amendments. It was also amended in his committee with the Dash 12. You can go into the record. I'm happy to also tell you what they are. But there are many, many, many ways in which we've narrowed this bill. So rather than go through the bill, I want to just list a few topics that I would be happy to answer questions on that basically rebut some of the opposition that you heard yesterday. One has to do with product. The removing toxic chemicals from products is too complex. I am happy to go into that. I'm happy to give you examples. Number two, federal TSCA reform, the Toxic Substances Control Act, will address the issue. I went back to Washington, D.C. I've lobbied on TSCA reform. I get weekly update calls from Senator Merkley's office, Adrian Devaney, who's been working on this. I know Representative, former Congressman Kurt Schrader has also been working on it. I am very up to date with that legislation. Happy to talk to you about how this fits in with the attempts at federal regulation. Third, that we are not harmonizing our law with other state laws. Happy to refute that. We've worked very, very hard at that. Fourth, that it will be too expensive to implement. It is not. I'm happy to go through expenses with you and say what a minuscule investment this is to save billions of dollars, $1 billion a year associated with costs that are environmentally attributed to children's disorders. And finally, that the products covered under this bill are already safe. As the toy industry mentioned yesterday, that is absolutely not the case. We would not be spending years and years and years of time to try to fill in the gaps if it was already covered. So I'm happy to answer any of those questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. Like you, I have heard the testimony on the health concerns and the concerns about our children, and I appreciated those remarks and agree with them. I come to you with a slightly different perspective. I think, as most of you know, when I'm not here at the Capitol, I am the owner of a small company that manufactures, distributes, and retails kites. And as a small company in that kind of business where most of the products that we produce have our own brand name on them, we would most likely be subject to this proposed piece of legislation. The kind of legislation which I think small companies most often are challenged to try and address. It's harder for small companies that don't have the resources and the infrastructure to deal with the same kind of requirements that are placed on them as would be on larger companies. And all that being said, I'm here to support the bill. You know, it was not so long ago that that we received notice from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission that we would have to start testing all of our products for lead content. And when I say all of our products, I mean every component of each of our products in every color. Now, that is an onerous requirement. That was a requirement that was going to challenge us to bring new products to the market. It was going to cost us tens and tens of thousands of dollars that we couldn't afford. It might well have pushed our small company under. That requirement was eventually withdrawn in the face of broad opposition from the toy industry, but I wanted to use that as an example of something that's difficult in comparison to what we have before us today, which I find a very acceptable kind of model. Check to see whether your products have bad stuff in them. If they do, then stop using the bad stuff. If you find out later that you've got bad stuff, well, stop using it then. Those are the kind of requirements that a small company like mine can live with. And I don't want to suggest to you that this is an entirely simple process. In my own case, we work with two production sources. We have excellent relationships with each of them. We have confidence in them. When we ask them a question, we believe the answers they give us. But we make kites. And the people that make our kites for us may get their fabric from one location and their sticks from another location and their string from a fourth location and the plastic winders that string goes on from a fourth location. And we don't know those people that are two or three levels removed from the people that we have a working relationship with. So it's hard to have complete confidence in the information that we bring forward. In the case of this bill, if we find out down the road that that there is a problem, we can address that problem, and we welcome the partnership of other players in this process that will help us identify problems. You know, at the end of the day, like most of the businesses that have reported to you, good companies don't want to do bad things to kids. I think that's the bottom line. And so speaking as one of those companies that would potentially be subject to this measure, I'm here with my strong support.
Could I add two firsts really quickly, very briefly? This is the first time, Madam Chair, this is the first time that on the record I've been referred to as moderate. So I'll take it. I don't know if that's good or bad. Secondly, this is the first time from the stand I've had to send text messages back and forth with staff that is needing me for a vote in Senate Finance any moment. So I may have to dart. So.
Thank you. Well, first, are there any questions specifically for the senator in case he has to leave immediately? Any other questions then?
I do have a question, but any three of you probably could answer it. One comment is I'm finding that long enough exposure that this bill becomes toxic for the members here.
Okay, the same. The time to end that.
So thank you. My major concern is how well the system of that we're setting up here relates to the Washington system as far as looking it up. Do I have a problem with this toy or this piece of equipment? How well are those two lined up with each other? How close are they? I hear that they're not the same. I hear they are the same. What is the truth?
You want to take the first crack and then leave?
Sure.
Say whatever.
So the definitions, as to my knowledge, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, to my knowledge, the definitions of contaminant and intentionally added are the same. And so you have what is now contemplated in Dash 18. Sometimes I have to think about this. So the reporting requirement, there's a reporting requirement unless you have a manufacturing control program that will be defined in rule by the Oregon Health Authority. And there's a reporting requirement on contaminants above 100 parts per million. Did I get that right? I did get that right. Okay. And then the phase out that happens in the out years, which actually doesn't come into effect because you have a year of rulemaking, and by the time you stack it all up, we're looking at year 8 before the phase out comes into effect, and then the phase out is where it's really where we differ from the state of Washington. State of Washington does not have a phase out, and we do. Our phase out has a number of provisions in it for waivers. So if you wanted to, I mean, you could either just get rid of the chemical altogether. You could substitute it for something. You could substitute a different chemical by doing a hazard assessment that shows that it's not any worse than the original chemical that you're getting rid of. You could apply for a waiver that is based on technical or financial unfeasibility of phasing it out, or you could apply for a waiver based on showing that there is no exposure. You know, it's in a piece of a toy there's just no exposure to a child. So by doing an exposure assessment.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. So I, just to get it on the record, because I've been saying it every time we started, since you started this legislation, if these things are bad for kids, they probably aren't good for adults either. So can you assume that if a component, chemical, whatever, is prohibited from being used in production of a child's item, it would also be eventually phased out or whatever from an adult item, because the adult item is likely to be in the same home as the child in many cases, and therefore the child would have exposure to something. And people who are maybe not as old as I am, but between child age and middle age, has there been any assessment at all on how things like this affect long term, for example?
Well,
adults.
I guess my own take on that is I don't know that we can assume what a manufacturer is going to do in terms of phasing out the worst of the worst chemicals in products meant for adults. The legislation targets children's products specifically because that is when human beings generally are most susceptible and vulnerable. So in utero and in those early years when they're developing neurologically and all those pathways and the body's growing, that's when they're most susceptible to the toxicity. And I would never sit here and say that a lot of these chemicals are great for adults either, but that is really why the program focuses on children's products. And I also did forget to mention that the phase out, in the eventual phase out, really applies just to products that are either mouthable or intended for children under 3 years of age, or are applied to the skin. So, you know, other products that are meant for, you know, a video game console or something like that, that's not, you know, that's not the intended audience, and so it wouldn't apply to, the phase out would not apply to those products.
Can I want to let you know that we do have at least three other committee members with additional questions, so we'll need to move really quickly through the responses.
Can I just say something really quickly in response to both of those? One is that this bill has been narrowed tremendously. Originally, many of the products were going to be 18 and under, but the difficulty in saying what is for teenagers, because it crosses over to adults, we ended up going with the 12 and under. Basically, over the last 3 years, this bill has narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. So that's one thing. In Maine, for instance, Their toxic safety law applies to pregnant women. Ours did not. Again, you know, we narrowed it to the birth to 12 population. A lot of people not happy about that. That was a compromise. I would also say, Senator Bates, in response to your question about how might it be different from Washington, one of the primary differences is that we exempt manufacturers that have annual sales of under $5 million. Again, the thought was most of the groups who manufacturers who have sales of over $5 million and are selling in Oregon are probably selling in Washington too, and they can take those results if they're already reporting them in Washington. We have worked over and over and over again, and thank you to Representative Conger and Senator Edwards in particular for making sure that we can do this in a way that can work really well with industry.
I want to accommodate all of the desire to ask questions, so the questions should be short and the answers brief, because everybody is lining up with questions. Steiner Hayward is next.
Thank you. Simple question. Do the Dash 18s change the perspective or approach of any members of the groups that are opposing it? Do they bring anybody to neutral? Do they bring anybody in support? How does that help the process?
I can speak to that. The Dash 18s, the Dash 18s probably do not get some of the opponents to yes. The opponents have been against the bill, have been publicly against the bill, are still against the bill. I believe that the Dash 18s, while narrowing the applicability and lining it up a little bit more with the state of Washington, head off opposition that I could see coming down the tracks. And so so there's some opposition that is not going to be opposition because of the Dash 18s.
Okay. Some have moved to neutral or support.
Well,
so
I guess I just need to understand then, are we just trying to avoid additional opposition? Because if it doesn't get people who are currently opposed to at least neutral, then why would we want this loophole added in?
I committed, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I committed when we had the bill in the Senate and we were approaching, in the policy committee, and we were approaching deadlines and we were still in negotiations back and forth with either potential opponents or on the record opponents, that we would keep those negotiations going and going as we moved it past, you know, the bill deadline is why we needed to move it on to Ways and Means. And so we continued those discussions, and we wrapped those up this past week. So.
Okay. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not nearly as familiar as some of my colleagues with this bill as they are, but a couple just surface-level logic things for me that if you could clarify. I'm trying to understand if Washington is perceived, their policies are perceived as a step ahead, why wouldn't we begin by matching that rather than leaping past that? And with that, and specifically, there's an assumption. A moment ago, you talked about, you know, tracking this and really understanding what's going on with it, but then that goes into an assumption of a phase out of what we assume that data is going to be. So I'm a little confused on why do we assume that we would have to phase it out as opposed to just tracking it first. And with all that, policy-wise, with the feds really moving forward on some policy things along these lines, and even talking about preemptions on this and so forth, why wouldn't we kind of wait and see what happens with that? So I know that's a handful to answer.
Okay, so two things. One is we've worked very closely with Washington Department of Ecology that has implemented this, and we are able to build on the rulemaking and the lessons learned. They have a great report that comes out that talks about where most of the toxic products are showing up, and what they would like to do now is move to a phase-out of where some of the worst chemicals for where the greatest exposure is. And so we are trying to – states are working very closely with each other to kind of – work hand in hand. And for us to just replicate what they've done, frankly, would not do that much at this point, disclosure, because a lot of the companies are already disclosing in Washington. And so this is what really moves the ball forward. I want to say something about the TSCA reform, having lobbied for it directly. There's three different proposals on the table right now. Two on the Senate side, Boxer's and Udall's, and Merkley is working on the Udall one, which is considered more moderate. And then Schrader is working on the congressional side, on the Congress representative side. All of those would take a long time. First of all, the TSCA reform has been voted on, I think, 5 or 6 times in the last decade. It is very hard to move anything in Washington. And for states to sit back and wait for something to happen there doesn't make sense, which is why a number of states have gone ahead. There are many other examples we could give, California, Maine. Some of the opponents say, why aren't we following that one? Those, in fact, are way more comprehensive, involve more chemicals, and way higher cost. But secondly, even if it did get passed, it would take years and years and years to implement. First of all, you'd have 3 years and 6 months to take action on certain priority chemicals. The Senate bill requires EPA to prioritize 25 chemicals over 5 years, and then the preemption is once they've identified a certain chemical, they say to the states, anything that you've passed is preempted, and you have to wait 3.5 years until we come up with our plan. Once they come up with a plan, if they are going to regulate it, then their law goes into effect, and we stand back. But the general response to that is it's going to take years and years and years. And if we are going to wait until your children who are in kindergarten now are going to be in high school for these kinds of things to take effect, it's way too late.
Representative Olson.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have two parts questions, and the first two are very simple. Looking at and this is more Linda for you, in the impact from LFO on this thing for the cost general funds for this next biennium is considered to be $87,000 and then an increase up to $409,000 for the biennium of 17 to 19. I know you're not going out into 2019 or 21 yet, but it appears to me from the implementation of everything of this bill, if it were to move forward, we're talking about well into the millions. I'm just.
Yeah. I'm not.
So you're not there.
Sure. Can I take a crack at that then, please?
Yes, and I'm going to announce that I will need to leave in a minute or two, but I will hand the gavel to my co-chair until the response to the question is completed.
Thank you. May I go ahead and answer?
Sure.
Thank you, Representative Olson, for that question. So the first year does not include a full year, and it includes mostly rulemaking process and bringing on a part-time research analyst, part-time toxicologist. The second biennium, the reason it's so high, the 409,000, is because that's the year in which they actually have to either contract out or do in-house putting together the database for the first time, and that is projected to come to over $100,000 to actually put the database together. After that, there's some IT work in keeping it up, but it's nowhere near as close. So if you went out a third biennium, it would drop down by probably over 100,000. When you get out to 6-8 years from now, when you're trying to incorporate the phase out piece of it, it would probably come back up to somewhere in between the 300 and 400. Maybe it would be even between 400 and 500. It'll depend on how many of those chemicals we start needing to track, and we'll see what the cost is at that point. But it would be in that same ballpark.
Okay. Just follow up on that. This one here is going to be a little bit more involved, but what it is that, and I know neither one of you have been part of the Measure 91 committee, but there was testimony yesterday, which I found rather interesting, from Dr. Stanley, that, and she identified this to the point where with these chemicals, it has been estimated that millions of IQ points have been lost in the U.S. The irony between this is just totally incredible from what we've heard and listened to with marijuana. I mean, because we're coming back, you know, and Sir Edwards, I appreciate, you know, you identifying kind of the imprinting stage, you know, between birth to 6 years old for the impact. But we're also talking about the neurological side of, you know, the youth, too, that are going to be impacted by this, because the studies have revealed, and we had a couple ladies come in front of our committee that just shared that we're talking about losing anywhere from 8 to 10 points IQ by being involved with, you know, using marijuana on a regular basis. So I'm just kind of seeing some, it doesn't make sense to me that we're going here, but we're going there with marijuana, and we're dealing with IQ. I don't get it.
So just a quick response. I brought those two women in to your testimony, to your committee to testify, because I am passionate about also making sure that we reduce exposure of any kind of marijuana products to pregnant women and to young children. This is my huge passion in the legislature, and it's very, what you just said is very consistent. I have bills, as you know, about labeling and packaging and other thing, and education for pregnant women and children. So very consistent with what this bill is trying to do, and thank you for working on that.
So anything we just follow, so you'll be opposed to anything from Measure 91, right?
No, I'm opposed to strong regulation where it protects children.
I second what the representative says, and I don't care, representative, how you vote on Measure 91. I do care how you vote on this, though. So
thank you.
Does that conclude the questions? Thank you for being with us this morning. I'm closing this public hearing. There's no more business at our committee this morning. We are adjourned. Oh my God. Get them out of the way. Get them out of the way.